Ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll start the second of the three Robins lectures. Those of you who came yesterday will already be familiar with the sparkling style and wit of Professor Daron Acemoglu of MIT and also of the LSE during his first part of his career. And he's going to talk today about towards a theory of institutions. Now, I'm sure if I can speak as Lionel Robbins, his son-in-law, that he would have approved very much of the linkages between politics and economics, which are implicit in this whole subject. Although at one time I seem to remember that when the Treasury got really frustrated in this country in the 1970s, they said, I think we better call in the anthropologists. Well, I'm not quite sure whether he's going to go that far, but anyway, we look forward to his second lecture very much. Daron, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I have to turn this on. Yeah, this seems to be working too. Well, thanks all for coming, and hopefully this is going to work better. Yes. So before I start, I should announce that these notes that I'm using for presentation will be posted on the CEP Lionel Robbins Lectures website, hopefully on Thursday or at the latest on Friday. And then, other than that, it's just a continuation of yesterday. So let me quickly recap the material that I covered yesterday. So in some sense, in the main message that I tried to convey yesterday is that there is a variety of evidence suggesting that institutional differences across countries are central in understanding the differences in prosperity and why some countries have grown in the past and have while others have stagnated, and why some countries are rich today and while others are poor. But in turn, I have gone into detail for thinking in thinking that to emphasize that institutions themselves are endogenous, and as a result, we have to think about what sorts of variation to exploit in looking at the effect of institutions. That was yesterday put more as a statistical inference question. We have to be careful in isolating the types of institutional differences in looking at their effects on income. And that's why we were motivated in looking at things like the Korean experience or the colonialism as a quasi-natural experiment. Today's lecture is going to turn to making some progress in understanding the endogeneity of institutions, why some countries have different institutions, why some countries have good institutions that encourage growth, while others have institutions that seem to discourage growth. And in this context, I'm going to talk about a variety of things from history, but part of the unity between the first and the second lectures is going to be that I'm going to come back to the experience of the colonization and try to explain some of the facts that I showed in the previous lecture. So in particular, I'm going to try to make sense of the reversal of fortune that I documented yesterday. Other than that is the order of stuff that I'm going to discuss. I'm going to talk about some different meta-theories of institutions, and especially, and then come back to economic institutions, political institutions, and the key concept that is going to occupy us a lot today, political power. And I'm going to discuss this in the context of some historical examples, which we'll see. The part that's missing from my outline is that I'm going to use what we've learned from this part of the lecture to discuss the reversal of fortune and the colonial experience. And then this is going to take us to a theory of institutions, which will then be applied in some other example. So if we agree that institutional differences are really important in understanding economic outcomes, then the next step is to ask why institutions differ across countries. Why some countries are governed as dictatorships while others are democracies, why some societies enforce property rights while others don't, while some societies allow free entry into lucrative businesses while others impose entry barriers. So in doing this, there are many, many approaches, perhaps more approaches than the number of scholars who have written on this, because many people have changed their minds on these difficult questions. But in some sense, it would not be unfair to say that many of these approaches fall within one of four broad categories, which I've called efficiency, ideology, history, and social conflict. Of course, some theories combine elements from two or more of these categories, but I think there are distinct ideas here, and it's useful to just talk about them a little bit before making more headway in understanding differences in institutions. The efficiency view basically claims that there is a strong tendency in society, either because of the purposeful actions of agents or because of some type of evolutionary process, towards efficient institutions. After all, if we can organize society in a more efficient way and we can increase the size of the social pie, why not do it? Why stick with things that are bad for society as a whole? So the major driving reasoning of the efficiency view is think of what's good for society. The second view, ideology, turns to importances and beliefs. In the efficiency view, implicit is in some agreement among key actors about what's going to be good for society. We may disagree in the short run, but eventually we're going to see things in the same way. Whereas in the ideology view, there are some persistent differences in societies, some persistent differences in beliefs across societies and among individuals about what's good for society. Some of us may believe legitimately that capitalism is the right way to organize the allocation of resources. Some others might believe in communism or central planning. Those are belief differences, and some of them are right, some of them are wrong. But we're going to stick to our beliefs, and our beliefs are going to shape the way that we structure society. The history view, on the other hand, is about the very strong tendencies towards persistence. The institutions we see today are basically the outcomes of things that were done many, 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 many years, many, many centuries ago. And in some sense, yesterday we saw the emphasis that I put on what happened 500 years ago. So clearly, there is some element of history in what I'm going to discuss. But in the most extreme view of the history view, in the most extreme version, there is almost a determinism that things are unchanging. And this is going to be in contrast to some of the ideas that I'm going to try to develop. And then the last one, social conflict, is in many ways similar to the efficiency view, that there are some evolutionary or purposeful actions that agents take. But the difference is that we're not all going to agree about what's good for society because we have different interests. Some may prefer entry barriers because the entry barriers would protect their profits or their rents, while others might want free entry. And an important element in understanding social conflict is what are the sources of social conflict and how do we resolve social conflict. And those are the themes that I'm going to try to develop. Of course, after putting four broad categories, the next step is to give you some sense of where I think the more fruitful direction lies. Which approach? So I'm going to argue the first three approaches are relatively insufficient, are essentially insufficient by themselves, that we really need an important element of social conflict in order to understand institutional choices and moreover in order to understand the facts that we talked about yesterday. In all of these cases, there are both theoretical and empirical reasons for why these approaches are not sufficient. In the case of the efficient institutions view, the presumption is that somehow we have ways of sorting out our differences that are going to bring the more efficient social arrangements in place. So this could be two possibilities. Either every social arrangement is going to make all of us better off. So every relevant social arrangement that we think about can be Pareto ranked according to the terminology of economists. They make everybody better off or everybody worse off. Well, you might think that this is not really so insane when we think of really big changes. You know, if the whole society stagnates, then everybody's going to be worse off. If the society grows rapidly, everybody's going to be better off. Nevertheless, when we look into the details, it's rarely the case that everybody is going to be better off, everybody is going to be worse off. At the end of the day, all institutions, because they determine the distribution of resources in society, because they shape incentives, they determine who's got the right to use assets, who's got the rights to profit, are going to create distributional consequences. There will be some winners and losers. So therefore, it's not simply the fact that efficient institutions are going to emerge because we all agree ex ante on what's good, what's bad. So therefore, there must be some ways of bringing about the more efficient choices by making deals across across different groups or across different individuals. One way of sorting out our differences is that perhaps those who will win, always, those who will win with the more efficient sorts of institutions will always be able to overwhelm the losers. So, for example, if capitalism is better than socialism, those who will benefit from capitalism will be able to force those who gain from socialism to adopt their particular choices. But that seems kind of difficult as well. It's not so easy to convince parties who are going to lose a lot from a particular choice to go along with it. So in some sense, if we are going to go ahead with an efficient institutions view, a theory based on efficient institutions, then we need that the losers from a beneficial institutional change should be compensated somehow. So if for the society it's better that entry barriers are abolished and we have free entry so that the more productive technologies, the more productive firms are those that get adopted and undertake the production, then we have to find some ways of compensating those who will lose, for example, the previous monopolist. If we are going to establish the right set of institutions in a society, we have to buy off those who were the beneficiaries of the wrong set of institutions. The problem is that, as I will go into greater detail later on, those type of transfers are in general not possible. It's just not feasible to make promises to people so that that are credible, that will convince them to give up a set of institutions, a set of policies that look after their interests. So, for a variety of reasons, the efficient institutions view is not going to be extremely compelling as a theoretical exercise. But much more important, the efficient institutions view is not really the right place for us to get an understanding for the facts that I've already talked about yesterday. Because the facts that I talked about yesterday were about some set of institutions leading to big poverty, while other set of institutions fostering growth. Well, it's very difficult to see that, to think that societies like the Democratic Republic of Congo under Mobutu were choosing efficient institutions, were choosing the set of institutions that were good for their growth. They were clearly choosing institutions that were not very good for their growth. And the same thing applies to North Korea. Ex post, at least, it's quite clear that North Korea chose the wrong set of institutions, and central planning and a communist political and economic system wasn't good for the citizens of North Korea, while its sister country, South Korea, grew rapidly. So we really need to understand inefficiencies in institutions because the facts don't look like efficient institutions. So could it be that really these inefficiencies are due to differences in beliefs? If we go back to North Korea versus South Korea, that doesn't seem like an insane idea. Clearly, you can develop the argument that those who set up the communist system in North Korea believed that communism was a better way to allocate resources. It was going to lead more to more equality, more happiness, better health outcomes, better outcomes in child mortality. And that the distortions that it would cause, if any, were small relative to the benefits that it would create. On the other hand, the people who wanted to separate South Korea from the North were convinced that communism was the wrong path. So these two groups had very different sets of beliefs. So perhaps if we want to understand the broad variation in institutions that we observed yesterday, the thing we have to turn to is differences in beliefs. Perhaps ideology is the driving force of the differences in institutions. There is clearly some truth to this view, both in thinking about the divergence in North and South Korea, and also in thinking about how different societies actually keep their different systems. If you think of different regimes surviving, a very important element is the beliefs of their citizens. And societies that can control them, the regimes that control, especially dictatorial regimes that control the media, and can convince their citizens that what they're doing is actually good and the alternatives are dangerous, are much more likely to survive. So all these belief dynamics are clearly important. The question is, however, can we get a big mileage out of these belief dynamics alone? And the answer there is, I believe, no. Even though differences between North and South Korea can be explained by belief differences initially, it's difficult to believe that the leadership of North Korea sincerely believed at the time of famine that closing their gates to the South and closing their gaze to the experiences that were growth-fostering in the South and in other areas of the world was in the interest of their citizens. Much more likely, and this is what's going to bring me to the institutions and social conflict, their beliefs were about their own rents, their own privileges, and their own position being threatened from a change in regime. And the same thing applies even much more forcefully when we think of the colonial experience. The same groups of colonialists, for example, the British, set up very different sets of institutions in very different colonies. While they opted for a system of democracy, property rights, and open society in North America, especially Northeast America, they developed a system of based on slavery and a very few individuals and families dominating both the politics and the economic resources of the society in the Caribbean. These similar or same groups were opting for very different sets of institutions. And these different sets of institutions, as we saw, had very different consequences for economic growth. It's very difficult to believe that it was their differences in their perceptions. And in fact, a very telling example is that almost the same group of people, the Puritans who went and set up the ideal Massachusetts Bay Colony in Northeast America, also went to Providence Island near Columbia. But there, when the local conditions were different, they set up a totally different system based on slavery and piracy, not the democratic system that they set up in the Northeast. It wasn't their beliefs that said in one place slavery is better, in the other place democracy and property rights and smallholder societies is better. There was something else. It wasn't just ideological difference. Was it simply history? Some historical accident that condemned some places to good institutions, some others to bad institutions? Again, history is very important. Historical persistence is going to be something I'm going to play on as I go along. But history by itself wasn't it. The Puritans, the British, the French, they were setting up colonies from scratch, they were setting up institutions from scratch in some of these places. And persistence is something that we have to explain, not something that we have to assume. Communist system showed a lot of persistence in North Korea. It's still there. But in other places it collapsed. There was an element of choice. Segments of society in Soviet Union, in Poland, and Hungary wanted change, and the elites, the Politburo of the party, gave in. They went along with it. Whereas in North Korea, neither the opposition developed, nor did the leadership decide to make changes. So although history sets up the scene, sets up the canvas on which these different games are being played, it is not does not determine it, and we have to understand these choices. So if it's not efficiency, it's not a very strong tendency towards efficiency, it's not pure differences in beliefs or ideology, and it's not simply something that's determined by history, then what? I will argue it's some process of social conflict that's important to understand institutions. Institutions are social choices. They're not imposed on society by some external group. The society itself chooses. When we have a democracy, that's because there is an agreement among the citizens that there is going to be a party that's elected, and the leader of that party or the parliament are going to make certain choices, both economic, political, and social. Whereas in some other societies, there is an agreement that dictatorship is going to go ahead. It's not an agreement in the sense that everybody is happy with it, but at the end of the day, it's still a social choice. It's a collective choice that we've made as a society. But how do we make these collective choices? The point that I tried to emphasize when we talked about efficiency is that it's not pure efficiency. It's not that we're all winners or losers. We're not talking about a society suddenly deciding to take its wealth and throw it away. The institutions that we're talking about are things like entry barriers, whose property rights to enforce, what type of economic contract laws to develop so that individuals can write contracts. How do we structure bankruptcy so that when you cannot pay your debts, your assets are allocated? How do we make political choices? Is there separation of power? Is there a dictatorship? And all of these institutions create winners and losers. In the clearest example, when we put up large entry barriers, the monopolist who is protected is the winner, and the consumers and potential entrants are the losers. So if there is this type of conflict, and we cannot just always reach the efficient outcome, how do we make collective choices? Collective choice at some level sounds as if we are all getting together and we're agreeing on something that's good for all of us. But that's not it. We've seen it's not just efficiency. So collective choice at some level has to have an element of social conflict. We're going to collectively decide something, but there are some groups who are happy with it, there are some other groups who are unhappy. How do we resolve social conflict? What I'm going to argue is that, as in other situations of social conflict, conflict in collective choices or social conflict is also resolved by power. If there is a disagreement about who is going to grab a piece of land, and there are two claimants, and nobody else, we're in the natural state that no laws govern our interaction, whoever has more power is going to grab that piece of land. Whoever has more political power, whoever has more power is going to overwhelm the other side. And in the situation of social conflict, in the situation of collective choice that we're thinking about, the relevant notion of power is political power. Whichever group can amass more political power is going to have its way. But what is political power? That's what we need to discuss, and that's where we're going to go. But the first thing I would like to do is say a few more things about why this approach is empirically more promising and why it has good foundations. And then I'm going to go through a couple of historical examples to illustrate, in fact, the role of political power and how political power is formed. And then I will go and give more careful definitions about political power. Part of the reason why this approach, based on social conflict, is going to be promising is because it's going to give us not only an empirical framework where inefficient choices of institutions, like those in sub-Saharan Africa or Central America or Caribbean, get made, but also give us an insight why in some places the choices are efficient while in other places they're not. So in the terminology of economics, it's not only going to give us an understanding of efficient and inefficient institutions, but also comparative statics. So we can say these societies are likely to develop efficient institutions, good institutions that encourage growth, and these other societies are likely not to. And it's all going to go through political power and the allocation of political power. And the key thing is this word here, distributional implication. It's not simply that we are trying to use institutions in order to increase the size of the social pie, the GDP or the growth potential of the society, but different groups are striving to achieve different aims. There isn't just growth, but there is growth for you and growth for me. And that's the distributional implication. But why, you might ask? You might still not be convinced that efficient institutions approach is not the right one. You might still be thinking at the back of your mind that there should be some way of solving these problems. Why on earth would a society stick with the institutions like those of Democratic Republic of Congo, or Zaire as it was called under Mobutu, which were just so disastrous? And just for your information, if you remember from yesterday's chart, Zaire was at the bottom in terms of property rights. It was at the top in terms of corruption. And if you were an investor in Zaire, for sure you were going to be expropriated. And as a result, in the course of about 30 years, Zairean GDP halved. So these were really disastrous institutions. So why don't we just contract around them? And the key thing here is commitment. There is a serious commitment problem or credibility problem when we are dealing with political power and social choices. The only way that Zaire could have moved to a more efficient set of institutions was to convince Mobutu, either by force or voluntarily, to give up his privileges. He was the one who was amassing an enormous wealth. He was the one expropriating other people's assets. He was the one getting all the tax revenue and not investing in public goods. And there was no way he was going to give up this position. The only way is you would buy him off. You would say, well, give this up, and then we'll compensate you somehow in the future. We'll treat you really well. We'll make, you know, we'll tax and allocate half of the tax revenue to you. But any promises like that would be not credible. In the same way, any promises that Mobutu would have made to the rest of society saying, no, 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 you should go and invest. I will not expropriate your assets would not be credible. Because the issue with political power is that if you have it in your hands, how can you not use it when it's in your interest? If I have a relationship with my business partner, I can make commitments. I can say, I'm going to deliver goods to you in the future. You can rely on my supply. Or I can borrow money from you, and I will promise I will repay. Why is that? The answer is because there is an outside agency, somebody else standing above us, with the power to enforce our agreements. If I write a debt contract with you and I owe you $1,000 or £1,000, if I don't honor that contract, you can take me to court, and the court will force me. And why will the court force me? Because it has the power to do so. That's why bilateral contracts or multilateral contracts between private citizens are possible. But not so possible when one of the parties has the monopoly of political power. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the political power was the monopoly of Mobutu and his clique. How could you write contracts with them? And that's the essence of the commitment problem, and that's the essence of the inefficiencies that are going to arise. So let's now go and look at some historical examples in order to get a little bit more insights about the use of political power in economic institutions. So what I'm going to talk very briefly about, given the time, are three cases. First, land relations in the Dutch East Indies, early financial institutions in the Americas, Mexico versus the United States, and price regulation in Ghana, Kenya, and Colombia. And then I'll take stock from these examples and go to the colonial experience, which is, I'm sure, many people are curious about how many of these ideas go back there and how we can make more progress in understanding the reversal of fortune we talked about yesterday. This, in some sense, is the most sinister example of political power and economic institutions. It is deceptively simple, and that's why it's a useful place to start. The Dutch were one of the colonizing powers, and much of the colonization of the Southeast Asia for the Dutch was done through the Dutch East India Company. And the great prize for the Dutch East India Company, especially in the early 17th century, were spices, the most profitable things that you could extract from the colonies in Indonesia and in that area and bring back to Europe to sell for high prices. And a very valuable place were the Malacca Islands, in particular the big island of Ambon and the Banda Islands. And these were useful for a variety of spices, nutmeg, cloves, and mace that they enabled to produce. When the Dutch went in those places, they encountered very different sets of economic and political institutions. But they wanted to set up their own economic institutions that were not necessarily good for the locals, but good for them. And what was important for them? What was important for them were two things. To get a lot of spices produced cheaply, that's what they wanted to get out. And very importantly, exclude the British and the Portuguese. Because the British and the Portuguese were after the same thing, spices. Ambon was quite easy. When the company, the Dutch East India Company, took over Ambon, they encountered an existing feudal structure. Just like the one in Europe a couple of centuries ago, with people tied to their land, with very little freedom, and a very hierarchical structure. The company immediately took over the existing feudal structure. It didn't modify it, it just took it over. There were the previous lords who were the beneficiaries of these resources before. They decided what to do with the land, now it was the company. So the feudal structure, the feudal land relations continued in Ambon as they were before. And a classic by Tim van Zanden, an economic historian of the Dutch colonization, explains this in a very nice way. The feudal structure was especially useful for the Dutch, for the company, because it enabled them to monopolize the supply. There were clear lines of supply going from the peasants to the top of the hierarchy, and they could just take it. Ambon was easy. What about the Banda? The Banda was much harder because they actually encountered a very different set of economic and political institutions. Instead of the feudal structure, they encountered semi-autonomous cities, semi-urban areas, with working with a trade network of themselves and their own particular relation. In the same way as they treated Ambon, they decided to just take over the existing system. But that didn't work. Not simply because labor wasn't cheap. That was a problem. It wasn't the feudal structure that would enable cheap labor supply. But much more important, the cities, with their trading structure and autonomy, basically refused to deal simply just with the Dutch, with the company, and they went behind their back and they dealt with the Portuguese and the British and the Portuguese. As a result, the company couldn't achieve its aims. But political power rested with the company. They had the military superiority. They decided to change the system, and they sent the military. It wiped off the population of the Banda Islands and imported slaves and set up a slavery system even more extreme than the feudal structure. This is a sinister example because it shows the use of political power in its most extreme force, in its most extreme way. Force, pure military brute force. But this pure military brute force was used for a particular purpose, so that the company could shape the economic institutions for its own benefit. Its own benefit was to monopolize the production and the trading in the spices. They wanted to achieve that. The welfare of the rest of the society, the indigenous people of the Banda, didn't matter. It's extreme, but it's not unique. Monopoly and capturing rents features in other examples as well. Mexico and the United States in the 19th century, at the end of the 18th century, were not as different as we might think today. GDP per capita, to the best of the estimates, were similar in the two places. The United States was already on its way to becoming a democratic place with smallholder institutions. But it wasn't as democratic as allowing universal male suffrage. It was a process that through the 18th century and the 19th century, voting rights were extended and all of that. But still, towards the end of the 18th century, there were still many similar places. Despite these similarities, when we look at another important economic institutions, financial institutions, banking institutions, how the banking structure was organized, there were big differences. Stephen Haber, a historian at Stanford who specialized on Mexico and also early North America, describes the situation just at the turn of the 18th century, early 19th century as follows. Mexico had a banking system monopolized by a few banks. In total, apparently, there were 42 banks, but really two banks monopolizing almost all of the Mexican banking industry. The US was the other extreme, 25,000 banks in the United States at the turn of the 19th century. The most extreme free banking. Now, you might complain about free banking. Regulation is hard. It might be chaotic. But the outcome was that whatever inefficiencies the banking system in the United States had, it was far more efficient than the one in Mexico. In Mexico, as you might expect from the monopolized structure, the banking system was just a way for the elite dominating the banking system to give loans to their friends and families. Most of the loans that these banks made went to to companies dominated, run by the members of their boards. It was a small group, they excluded everybody else, and that was the industrial structure. In the United States, the situation was very different. Why were financial institutions so different in Mexico and the United States? Again, it comes to political power. In Mexico, the power of insiders, the elite, which were the owner of the banking system, monopolizing both the banking system and the industry, were very powerful. Especially supported by the dictatorship of Diaz, they could do whatever they wanted, and what they wanted to do was also in line with the interests of the governors, because they liked monopoly. It was run by their friends, and it generated easy money for them to tax and share in the revenues. In contrast, the United States situation was very different. It wasn't very different, however, because the interests of the elites were different by themselves. In fact, quoting directly from Haber, even in the United States at the end of the 18th century, it was not in the interest of state governments to charter a large number of banks and create a competitive market. They also wanted to support their friends. They also wanted the monopoly profits that they could easily tax. But they could not achieve their objectives. Even though they had similar objectives to those insiders in Mexico, they couldn't achieve their objectives because they didn't have the political power. And the reason they didn't have the political power was a combination of two things. First, political institutions were very different in the United States. While Mexico was a dictatorship, the United States was already on its way towards universal male suffrage. And voting put serious constraints on the actions of the governors, both at the state level and the federal level, like Alexander Hamilton. Moreover, in the United States, the thing that was scarce wasn't capital so much. It was labor. The open frontier at the time meant that if you didn't run your state in an efficient way that was beneficial for the people, they would just migrate away. So the constraints were very different on American politicians, and that limited their political power. As a result, the politically powerful Mexican elites could have a monopolized system and run it for basically 200 years. In the United States, they had the same objectives, but it didn't work. Another example of economic institution is the regulation of prices. Agricultural prices are not always determined in free markets, but they are heavily regulated at times. In many agricultural countries, in many agricultural markets, marketing boards are a prime example of determining prices. Marketing boards were forced form in many places, especially in Africa, as a way of preventing large price fluctuations. Marketing boards would buy the supply and then supply it to the market. So rather than competitive middlemen, a government agency, the marketing board, would do the buying from the producers and then sell it. But the marketing boards, especially after independence in Africa, became a very different beast. And the classic study of African politics and African agriculture is by Robert Bates. And what Robert Bates describes is how marketing boards came to be dominated by politicians and used in many countries, for example in Ghana and Zambia, as a way of extracting a large amount of surplus from agriculture. In Ghana, for example, the major produce was cocoa, and much of the economy depended on cocoa. And what the marketing board did was buy cocoa at very low prices, and it could because it had the right to set prices. Very different set of system of setting prices. And the reason why it could do this is because it was controlled by the state that had the political power. In Kenya and Colombia, which is not an African country, but also had a marketing board, played with a marketing board at some point, the policies were much more pro-farmer. The marketing board in Kenya used to support the price of coffee, in Colombia the same, rather than suppress it. And Bates wrote his classic, trying to understand why Ghana pursued these disastrous policies that ended in such low prices for cocoa that cocoa production basically fell to zero, and whatever was produced was smuggled out of the country rather than sold through legal, legitimate means, versus Kenya didn't go through those same disastrous policies. And the conclusion he reached was political power. In Ghana, the politicians were totally unaccountable to the major producers of cocoa. They were in the urban centers from a different ethnic background and trying to juggle too many different balls, in particular trying to keep the urban interests happy and their own ethnic groups happy. They didn't care about the Ashanti who produced the cocoa. And therefore, taxing the cocoa revenue was just an easy and obvious strategy for them. In Kenya, on the other hand, agriculture was dominated by large landowners. They were politically powerful and you couldn't ignore them. And their political power ensured that policies were looking after their own their interests, not ignoring them. Colombia is similar. Farmers had considerable political power, but not because they were large farmers, for a different reason. Because Colombia was much more democratic than these other countries. And even though coffee farmers were relatively small, they could still have considerable political power through the electoral process. And quite tellingly, there was one period during which in Colombia, coffee prices were depressed by policy in order to extract resources from the farmers. And that was during the dictatorship. Because during the dictatorship, the accountability disappeared, the political power of the farmers disappeared, therefore the dictatorship could go ahead and use this power in order to depress prices and extract the resources. Therefore, all of these three cases highlight the same issue. The role of political power. Before political power, however, it's also obvious that social conflict is in the background. Social conflict in the Moluccas is quite easy to see. The Dutch East India Company was choosing the institutions for its own benefits, for its own profits, not for the benefit of the large number of native inhabitants of the islands. They didn't matter anything for them. And in fact, they were happy to kill them if necessary. In Mexico, the political and economic elites did not think of the financial institutions as a way of fostering growth. They didn't ask themselves which financial institutions will be best for growth. The question, which financial institutions would be best for us? Which financial institutions would enable us to form a system that was in our interest and tax the revenues? But political power was again determinant. In Mexico they had the political power, in the United States they didn't. And the same thing in Colombia, Ghana, Kenya. Low prices and a disastrous form of economic regulation of prices in Ghana was not done because it was in the interests of the cocoa farmers. It was explicitly done so that those resources could be taken and redistributed to the different ethnic group and to urban interests that were the threatening group at that point. So the key lesson that I want to draw from it is that in the presence of social conflict, which seems to be just ubiquitous here, this political power is going to matter. If you have the political power, you have your way. But that's not it. Political power has a first-order effect on economic institutions, but also political power seems to be affected by a variety of things. In the Kenya and Ghana example, economic institutions determine political power or influence political power. If you were the small farmers, you didn't have political power. You were too poor, too disorganized. If you were the large farmers, you had political power. That's why in Kenya, the farmers had the political power. In the Mexico and the Colombia case, or Colombia versus Ghana case, we see another influence on political power, political institutions. The reason why in Mexico, political power rested with the elites was because it was not democratic. In the United States, they couldn't get away with the same thing. And in Colombia, again, farmers were protected by their power through electoral process, and when the electoral process was suspended, the outcome was very different. So where do we stand? We already have some clues towards a useful theory. We see the role of political power, and we already see some dynamic linkages between other determinants and political power. But the big question is still ahead of us. Comparative statics. When do we expect a society to end up with good institutions? When do we expect a society to end up with bad institutions? And here, I am still being relatively loose about good and bad institutions. And given the time constraints, I might have to be. Good institutions are those that encourage growth, that they encourage economic investments, that encourage new people to enter and invest, whereas bad institutions are those, just like in Mexico, that monopolize the resources and prevent the correct allocation of resources. Some obvious comparative statics should be already apparent. When do we expect a society to adopt good institutions? Well, we've already emphasized the role of political power. If a particular group holds political power in its hands, and it's going to determine what type of economic institutions the society will live under, then a first question to ask is whether good institutions are in their interests or not. The reason why the Mexican monopolists opted for a bad financial system was because an entry barriers that protected their rents, that enabled them to control industry and banking, was in their own benefit. On the other hand, the reason why Kenyan farmers did not want to have regulation of prices that depressed agricultural production was because those lower prices would affect them adversely. If you are the investors, if you have the right to invest, access to the assets that will be most beneficial, then you want good protection of property, right? You want good economic institutions to encourage growth. If you are the person who is going to benefit from expropriating others' resources, it's not so obvious. If you are the monopolist, you don't want free entry. If you are the outside entrant who is itching to enter, then you want free entry and you dislike entry barriers. Therefore, the economic interests of those with political power is central. The second key determinant is, what can you do with political power to extract resources from the rest? The reason why the political power of the Dutch East India Company led to disastrous consequences because there was a lot to be extracted from the bandas. The bandas enabled the production of nutmeg, which was the most valuable commodity at the time, and they just wanted that. Those resources out there gave them the incentives to go ahead and extract the thing without any respect for the human or economic rights of the citizens of the Banda Islands. And then the third thing are the constraints. Of course, the American elites might have wanted a monopolized banking system too, and many of them did, according to Steve Haber. But they couldn't, because there were constraints on their power. Political institutions and the open frontier left them few choices. So therefore, the three key comparative statics relate to the economic interests of those with political power, to what they can do with their political power, to the resources to be extracted, and to the constraints on their political power. So in this light, let us go back to the colonial experience. First of all, it's clear that history and ideology are not going to be sufficient to understand the colonial experience. We really have to think about social conflict and political power. First, things were not a historical accident. Europeans did restructure institutions. They set up the slavery system in the Caribbean from scratch. In some other places, they didn't. They took over existing institutions. But it was their choice, and they had that choice. And it wasn't ideology. The same British groups, as I pointed out, opted for very different organizations in different places. So we have to think about political power. And political power hopefully will give us some insights about the institutional reversal that we talked about. If you remember, the fact that was at the center of yesterday's talk was the reversal of fortune. Why the places that were relatively poor became relatively rich, and those that were relatively rich became relatively poor. And I tried to argue that was related to an institutional reversal. The places that were more densely settled ended up with worse institutions. But why? I think the comparative statics that I just talked about give us important insights. Europeans were the groups monopolizing political power. Of course, Europeans were not a monolithic entity. There was a lot of heterogeneity among the Europeans, and I wish I had more time to talk about them. But in fact, that conflict within them was very important in understanding some of the progresses, especially in the United States, Australia, and places. But Europeans as a group had the political power, and the indigenous people didn't. So the first thing to ask is, what was in the benefit of the Europeans? What was the economic interest of the group that monopolized political power? And the answer is that it varied from place to place. If the Europeans themselves were the settlers, were the people who will live under those institutions, then it was clear that they had a desire for better institutions, because they would live under those institutions themselves. If you are setting up a society, would you like to set up a society that is chaotic and your rights are going to be uncertain and violated most likely in the next few days or few years or few decades? The answer is probably no. And the European settlers thought that way. They were very keen on property rights, civil rights, political rights for themselves. But when Europeans didn't settle but viewed colonization as a project in extraction of resources, then their economic interests were not to protect the people, because it was the people that they wanted to extract resources from. So therefore, a key determinant of whether better institutions emerged in a colony would be whether Europeans settled and became a significant fraction of the population. And that happened in places that were initially sparsely settled. In North America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Europeans settled in large numbers. Even in Singapore and Hong Kong, which were uninhabited islands, Europeans settled. Whereas India, Central America, there was a dense population, and for a variety of reasons that I will discuss in greater detail in tomorrow's lecture, settlements were scarce. The second comparative static result told us that we should expect better institutions in places where there is more to extract. If you encountered a place with lots of gold and silver, lots of prosperity, there was more to extract, and that was the pattern of European colonization. European colonists at first used their power to extract, be it in India, be it in Central America or the Aztec Empire. But more importantly, the most important resource was not gold or silver. The most important resource was people. If you had a lot of people in a particular place, that was a lot of production power. They could produce spices, they could mine silver, and they could produce whatever they were doing before you went there, and you could just tax them. So Europeans adopted somewhat different strategies in different places, but whenever a place was densely settled, they viewed the population there as a resource to be exploited. In the Caribbean, it was the slavery system. In the Central America, it was forced labor and the tribute system. In India, it was taking over of the existing tax and tribute system. But in contrast, when there was nothing to extract, they themselves went settled, and they went after a society built on property rights, relatively democratic settled institutions. The third comparative static is also very useful for us to understand. We expect better institutions in places where there are constraints on political and economic elites. But that's exactly what happened in places that were previously sparsely settled, because Europeans themselves settled. And the lower strata of the European settlers demanded rights and put constraints on the elite. The original project of European settlement or European colonization in North America was not actually that different from Spanish America. Charles I gave charters for people to set up a feudal system, big manors and and grow produce for export as very much in other places. But it wasn't a viable system because these places were going to be manned by Europeans. And Europeans, as soon as they went there, either as indentured servants or in other capacities, sometimes as ex-convicts, as in Australia, or sons and daughters of convicts, immediately started asking for rights, political rights, economic rights. And when they weren't given, they went to the street and protested. And they weren't given, they migrated away to the open frontier and to the other areas. So the constraints on the people who were trying to manage the project of colonization were very different. And when there were more constraints on the elites, the outcome was again better institutions. It wasn't only economic institutions, however, and this is a point that's very important, and unfortunately one that I probably will not have too much time to elaborate on, but Europeans also structured political institutions. The people in the northeastern United States did not only want economic rights, they also wanted representation. Because representation was viewed as the only secure means to future economic freedom. It was viewed as the only secure means to have their rights in the future respected. And as a result, they ended up with more democratic institutions. In contrast, in the Caribbean, in Peru, in Guatemala, you had very different democratic institutions. And in some sense, that's obvious. If you're going to have an economic system that takes the resources from the majority of the population and gives it to a few, how can you expect democracy to flourish? If you have democracy, the many are going to demand a more equal distribution of resources, a more equal distribution of the slices of the cake. Whereas if you have a smallholder society, as in northeastern United States, democracy makes much more sense. And comparative static theory is again in action. Once political institutions were in place to constrain the use of power, then good institutions were likely to persist. And in contrast, when you have political institutions as in the Caribbean, or as in Central America, or in parts of Africa, monopolizing power in the hands of a few unchecked by anybody, there was a great tendency for bad political and economic institutions to persist. After all, if the state is designed to extract resources, not only today, but tomorrow, the political elites will want to use it to extract resources. This perspective is not only useful to understand the reversal, but it's also useful to understand the timing of the reversal. The reversal happened in the 19th century, as I already emphasized, it was related to industrialization. At some level, that's not surprising. The coercive institutions imposed by the Europeans were not extremely costly when they dominated the major productive opportunities. In the Caribbean, the political power rested in the hands of the plantation owners, especially the big plantations. And they also dominated the economic system. They produced much of the output of the Caribbean. But at first, this wasn't so costly because it was in their interest to increase output. After all, the Caribbean was sugar, and sugar went to their pockets. And as a result, in the between 16th and end of the 18th century, Barbados, Cuba, Haiti, Jamaica were among the richest places in the world. Not income per white, but income per capita, including the slaves. And they were rich because they were producing a lot of sugar, and they were good at producing sugar. But the situation changed when the major investment opportunities shifted to new areas. Industrialization was the rule of the 19th century. Countries that industrialized prospered, those that didn't industrialize staggered behind. And industrialization meant new people to enter as entrepreneurs, as firms, as producers. That meant new people to have rights. But in the Caribbean, in Africa, in Central America, these new people did not have rights. If you were an indigenous Indian in many parts of Central America, it was illegal for you to get education. You could not be literate. And in a situation like that, you couldn't expect these new opportunities to be grabbed by a broad cross-section of society. In contrast, in northeastern United States, industrialization quickly caught on. And it had a pattern that's very much in line with our theories. The people who were the engine of industrialization were not the old elites, but they were new people. They weren't sons and daughters of the Lord Baltimore's that started the big lands in the United States. They were new people, sons and daughters of indentured servants, without any status, but with the rights to enter into new areas, and with the financial institutions to give them money, because we saw United States had a banking system that wasn't designed for the elites. But the timing is very much consistent with the arrival of a new opportunity that could no longer be exploited by the existing elites. This brings me to a final thing that I want to talk about today. There are many more things, but I'm not going to have time. And that's problems of oligarchy. So many of you may wonder at this point, what are good institutions? I've talked about good institutions encouraging investment and property rights. And property rights are clearly essential. But whose property rights? What type of property rights? At a minimum, we want you to have access to the returns created by your assets. If you produce, if you invest, you should be able to get the return. But that's not enough. In Mexico, at the end of the 18th and at the beginning of the 19th century, there were property rights. Sure, later on there was a civil war, and that's not a great time for property rights. But property rights were fine. In India, as we discussed briefly yesterday, property rights were even codified by the British. The previous rights that were there were put in paper, and perhaps they were strengthened. But property rights, in this narrow sense, are not enough. If property rights mean I own everything, and I am the only one who can invest, that's not great, because you may have a better idea than I do. And I am preventing you, perhaps through entry barriers, through perhaps financial underdevelopment, through a political power that I command, from entering and using your better ideas, your human assets. So property rights, if you want to use that term, have to be defined more broadly. Property rights have to be not only that you have a right to your existing assets that are here as physical assets, but also a right to use your human assets efficiently. An oligarchy is a situation that satisfies only half of that. Oligarchy meaning a few rich families or people, the elite, the economic elite, dominating everything, is perhaps good because they will defend their own property rights. In the same way as the plantation owners in the Caribbean defended their own property rights. The biggest crime in the Caribbean was to of the plantation owners and steal their sugar. But what they didn't do is they didn't protect the freedom of the rest of the society, the 90% that were slaves or ex-slaves, to use their assets, their intelligence, their brains, to enter into new lines of new lines of economic activity, to become productive people. So oligarchy, therefore, is good to some degree because it protects the rights of the oligarch, but it has in itself the seeds of its own failure, because it protects only those. It concentrates powers in their hands and ignores the rest that are also productive members of society. And why in the 19th century is very related to oligarchy. Many of the societies that failed to grow in the 19th century but were relatively prosperous before the 19th century were the oligarchies that couldn't adapt because they couldn't become inclusive. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Darren, for that fascinating lecture, and I'm sure it sparked off quite a few questions. So there are mics, roving mics. Somebody put their hand up and the mic will come to you, front row.
I was just wondering about with your key lesson that political power leads to economic institutions.
Is your mic working?
Okay, sorry. You seem to, one of your examples, it seems to be a lack of political power that explains better institutions. But it just seems that a constraint on political power, your third, what you call the static, it seems not really a full explanation of a lack of political power. That seems to be, lack of political power seems to be more than a constraint on political power.
I think you're absolutely right in the sense that I've left a lot of that unsaid. And lack of political power has a bad connotation. It sounds like lack of capacity. So that's why I use the word constraints on political power. But what are these constraints? Where do they come from? And in some sense, that was my optimistic remaining part of my lecture. Really, to complete this picture, and of course I didn't have time for this, we need to think about where political power comes from and the political institutions like democracy, dictatorship, separation of power that affect political power. And if I had time, and I probably will not tomorrow because I have other things to cover, I wanted to talk about the jure and de facto political power, how there is a difference between the military power of the Dutch East India Company, which was de facto power without any constraints, and de jure power that's allocated by political institutions, like the political power of a prime minister in an electoral system. And I think to understand these dynamics is the critical thing.
Down here, mic, please.
How do you explain differences between the Northeast of the United States and the Southern United States? You tend to talk about the Northeastern United States, but both areas were obviously settled by people from Northern Europe, and both areas, so far as I know, were equally sparsely populated. But one, as you say, developed something like smallholder democracy, and the other is obviously a much more elite society, which is obviously based on slavery. Now, to explain that, do you fall back on what you talked about yesterday, namely geography and factor endowment, and it's something to do with the land and the ability to produce different crops, or do you bring in institutions?
Thank you very much. It's an excellent question. Let me answer it in two parts. And in some sense, some of this is the topic of my next lecture. I keep doing this. Whenever you ask a question, difficult question, I put it to the following day. I need to explain in greater detail what I mean by the relationship between geography and institutions, which is a topic I will turn to tomorrow. But leaving that aside, you're absolutely right. The South and the North were very differently organized and to some degree still are. But the difference is institutional in the sense that the big difference is the South went for a system based on slavery, very different distribution of income, very different distribution of political power, and the North went for a system based on smallholders' democracy. So at that level, it fits perfectly with my story. The South did not generate as much economic growth, and the North did. Moreover, the timing is extremely in line with the rest of the story. The South, at the turn of the 18th century, was probably slightly richer than the North, if not a bit more than slightly. But in the 19th century, it was the North that grew, not the South, and it was industrialization that took place in the North, not the South. So the only thing that's left is why the South did it differently than the North. And you're absolutely right. There is one explanation. It's the types of crops that were appropriate for the South were different from those in the North. The South allowed for cotton, tobacco, which were crops that were well with a system of slavery, mass production of sorts, in big landholdings. However, what I'm going to argue tomorrow is that there wasn't a fate. It wasn't a determinism that said these crops have to be produced in big land. After all, Queensland in Australia grew sugar in smallholder production. Coffee in Colombia and Costa Rica is grown with smallholders. In Nicaragua, Guatemala, Honduras, and other places, in much larger landholdings, very different land relations. So it is true that geography, during certain critical junctures, had an effect, but working through institutions and during critical junctures.
And the underlying institutions were very important. The reason why Costa Rica decided to grow coffee in a very different way, the reason why Queensland had sugar grown by native people, whites, rather than imported slaves or even indentured servants, was very related to political institutions at the time.
Question up there at the back?
Yeah, I just want to slightly worried about perception of self-interest. And I want to bring in the possibility that people can have mistaken perceptions of self-interest, especially in the choice of institutions, which are inimical to growth. People can serve self-interest in a myopic fashion, but can still be fooled in the long-run sense. And I think there are plenty of examples of such myopic mistakes.
I entirely agree in the sense that ideology, the way that I'm defining it, or perception differences, which I think is quite close to the way that I'm using the word ideology, are important in certain instances. And at some level, the divergence in the institutions of the old world between communism and capitalism cannot be understood without thinking about that. Why India went to a very different system after independence than many other places. Why the emphasis on planning cannot be understood without thinking about beliefs and perceptions. The point I was trying to make is, however, that this is not sufficient. Even though these perceptional differences exist, we also have to think about interests, because without the interest differences, the perception differences will quickly disappear. The reason why in North Korea today, still a large fraction of the population believes that communism is okay is because the media has been dominated by a small elite that has fed them these views. So the interest of the elite who wants to keep the existing system is quite important. And at some level, if you look at every dictatorship, even those the most vile ones like Mobutu's, try to solidify their hold by affecting people's beliefs. Mobutu came up with the ideology of Mobutuism. You know, for somebody who had halved the GDP per capita of its country in 30 years, that was quite daring. But it was important because that was the way he could remain in power. And these ideology differences, which I certainly don't want to minimize, are intimately linked to differences in the economic interests of the underlying group. And in the context of colonialism, which is the one that I focused the latter half of this lecture, I think ideological differences are quite secondary to the differences in the economic interest. After all, it was the same group of British colonists that set up the ideal societies of northeastern United States and the slave societies of the Caribbean. Thank you.
Question in the front row, gallery.
I would like to ask you to explain what do you think about the case of Argentina? Because here you have a country where the geographical conditions are similar to the northeast of the United States. You have a country where which was very scarcely populated, settled mainly by Europeans, with the ideals of the United States Constitution. And you could say there were a lot of liberal thinkers who went there, very turmoil political history. So. And yet, it seems to also, yeah, institutions which attracted a lot of investment, a lot of growth, but yet it's often said one of the Latin American countries with the weakest institutions. How would you explain that?
Thanks for the question. I think it's a puzzle. At the end of the 19th century, Argentina was very rich, richer than many places in Europe. And you're absolutely right. Argentina is as close to a settler colony as you can get without being New Zealand or Australia or the United States.
I was going to point out the parallel with Australia. These big primary producing southern hemisphere countries were very rich by world standards, and then they fell back. Australia is now catching up again. Is it possible that Argentina can do an Australia?
Oh, that would be even more difficult to answer than the existing question. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the growth in both Australia and New Zealand was spurred during the 19th century by their natural resources, and the processing of these natural resources that led to their industrialization to some degree. The problem in Australia, in Argentina, differently from Australia, is that political rights arrived later, at the beginning of the 20th century. And then once they arrived, they were in the midst of a lot of conflict. So before Perón, but also during Perón, where the groups that came to power used the political power to redistribute resources quite aggressively. And what that led to some degree, was a reaction from the other groups with the overthrow of Perón and reversal of the distribution of resources. So when you look at the share of income, GDP, that goes to labor, for example, it shows wild swings in Argentina. Jumps up when Perón comes to power, dictatorship throws Perón out, falls down. The question is, why didn't this type of distributional conflict take place in Australia? And somewhat, inequality perhaps was a factor. With the expansion of Argentina's lands to the outer areas, there were big landowners and some degree of inequality that never emerged in Argentina, certainly in Australia. And perhaps as a result of that, there was a backlash of political conflict with a much later democratization in Argentina. But beyond that, I think just a much more in-depth analysis is necessary.
Yes, question there.
I would like to know if you perceive any change in Mexico here. With the political change of Vicente Fox.
Oof, this is getting even harder. It's really difficult for me to say. You know, I think the election of Vicente Fox was an important landmark in the sense that it ended the continuation of the political domination of a single party. But on the other hand, Vicente Fox was also coming from the same group that oftentimes were supported by the PRI. I think overall, the perception that I get from people who follow Mexican politics more closely that the pace of reform has not been as fast as was hoped for. But the future, I think, is much harder for me, especially who doesn't know much about the current situation in Mexico.
Well, just one comment on that is that Mrs. Fox seems to be wanting to follow in the footsteps of Hillary Clinton. You know, if your husband doesn't quite achieve all his objectives as president, then the wife tries to do better. Maybe that'll be the answer. Just behind that, right.
Hi. I was just wondering if I could take you back to South Asia, and there are two important countries in South Asia, India and Pakistan, and they got their independence at the same time, and from the same colonialist power. And I was just wondering if you could throw light on why democratically they've taken different directions. I mean, we've had in Pakistan, out of 50 years, about 30 years of military dictatorship, and the rest of the 20 years as controlled democracy. And India has had 50 years of continuous democracy.
I think that's a wonderful question. I know there are many theories to do with who the bureaucrats were under Britain, the role of religion, the role of differences in the development of the areas before independence, but I think it's a question that requires a much more in-depth analysis than I would be able to give you on the spot. I think it's a fantastic area for future research.
A question down here.
Briefly rejoining the previous question, it is possible that the reason is the presence of very large restricted group of large landowners in Pakistan. Restricted group of large landowners in Pakistan has been often commented that they exert a break on the economic development of Pakistan. But my question is about the different trajectories after the colonization of different countries, in particular the different performance of Asia as against Africa. Has been noted by other students of economic development that in East Asia, and typical examples of Japan, for example, although it's not a post-colonial country, but also in Southeast Asia, is the presence of a large group of skilled farmers. And they have performed remarkably well, even in the absence of property rights. One thinks of what is happening in China now. How would you interpret this particular trajectory of development set against the general framework we have put forward before?
I think that's a very good question. It's absolutely true that human capital, education skills, is essential. And not only in industry, not only in new technology, but also in agriculture. A great example is the spread of the Green Revolution in India, which shows a great relationship to the skill and human capital of the farmers that were subjected to it. The question is, however, skills are not exogenous. In the same way as physical capital is made as a choice of the society, so is human capital. So for instance, South Korea, which is an example you have in mind, I presume, which has benefited from a very well-educated workforce, invested a lot in human capital precisely after the separation of the South and the North. Before then, human capital was not as high. So it was an effort, a decision of the political system to invest in human capital. And the same thing has happened in some countries and has not happened in others. Now, it's not true that human capital investments have always led to rapid growth. Some of the African countries have also invested in human capital, but that hasn't led to growth, partly because they have been in the middle of civil war or other terrible dictatorships. So investment in human capital was something that wasn't part of their overall development strategy. But I think the key question is, why do some countries invest in human capital and other assets at the same time, and therefore can make use of the most important growth opportunities like the Green Revolution or agriculture, or much more important, in other areas of manufacturing and services?
We've just got time for one more question. I see a hand raised here.
Thank you. It seems to me that the examples you've chosen are very conducive to a static analysis. That is, there's some clear time zero when a group of people came in and decided these are the institutions we're going to create, be it in this colony or wherever else. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about more institutions that evolve dynamically through time. I'm thinking specifically of the merchant law in medieval Europe that later on came to be the common law, which is a very important institution in the Western world.
I think you're absolutely right, and I have done it purposefully that way because I wanted to get across a number of simple ideas, and it made it extremely easier to start with time zero. But you're absolutely right. The reason why I could start from time zero was because this is an unusual case. In general, I think this is a much better representation, though of course it's loose, it's just arrows, and we have to put much more flesh, and that's what a lot of economic research that's going on right now is about. But the key determinant of institutions, political power itself, is not exogenous, it's determined by past choices. But of course, there are still critical junctures that change equilibria. And one of the examples that I wanted to talk about was not the merchant law, which is also an extremely interesting example, but was the rise of constitutional regimes in the in Europe, especially the English Civil War and the Dutch Revolt, and how that led to the development of a very different set of political institutions. And I think those type of dynamic analysis are extremely important. But again, the type of methodology that I'm advocating in the background makes it much easier if there are some discrete changes so that we can trace its effect. So the way that I try to do, and I'm not going to talk about it, although this doesn't have a time zero, start from a point of a big shock, which was the rise of Atlantic, which changed the economic institution, economic relations, and economic opportunities a lot. But I think, of course, to understand it, to get a broader view, we need to also know more about the business as usual of institutions.
Well, I'm afraid we have to draw the proceedings to a conclusion for this evening, but come back tomorrow. We have the third lecture at 6 o'clock tomorrow, and I'm sure we shall all look forward to the conclusion. I'd just like to point out, some of you may not remember, and maybe Darren is too young to know this, but one previous Robbins lecturer was the finance minister of Mexico, another one became the prime minister of Russia. I hope you'll do better than either of those did. Thank you.